Over the last months, I've been developing a new series of interviews, and as part of that, I've spoken to a number of folks who are partnering with external academics and others around some of the kinds of problems that I know fall under your purview. So, for example, I've talked to Pablo Fernicola about the add-in that's being developed for Microsoft Word to target the National Library of Medicine formats for scientific publications. I've spoken to Catherine Van Ingen about her collaboration with Dennis Baldocchi at Berkeley on the analysis of climate data. I've talked to Kirill Feinov about the HPC Plus+ program, which is putting cluster capability into the hands of professors and through them into the hands of students so that they can start to do experiments on large amounts of data. So these are all sort of, I think, pieces of the puzzle
Absolutely.
that you're chartered to solve. And so for people who don't have kind of the whole context, I'll just kind of briefly summarize and then you can jump in. But you're a person who's been at various times in your career a physicist and then a computer scientist. And then for a time in the UK led what was called, I guess, the e-science program.
What would in the US be called cyber infrastructure? I'm on the NSF's Advisory Committee for Cyber Infrastructure, and it's a very similar goal, multidisciplinary collaborative science.
Yeah. And then you surprised a lot of people by turning around and joining Microsoft. Although I can see lots of ways in which that probably wasn't so surprising. But why don't you kind of pick up the thread there and then maybe you can kind of move forward through the TCI, the Technical Computing Initiative phase, which is what you were mostly doing when I first spoke with you, and now on into this, I think, broader role that's called external research.
Okay, fine. So, yes, I mean, I had the experience as a physicist and as a computer scientist doing parallel computing for years, and then, did things like being chair of my computing science department and dean of engineering, which all gives me some familiarity with the problems of academics. And I think, therefore, I understand the community that we're trying to work with pretty well. The other thing that I did was for 5 years I worked running the UK e-science program, and that was about, if you like, distributed, typically huge amounts of data, collaborative, multidisciplinary sort of types of research. So it has most of those aspects, and that covers many fields from the environment to bioinformatics. Almost every field of science now has some elements of distributed networked collaboration. And what the science agenda was to try and make the tools and technologies so that becomes trivial for them to do in the way, for example, that with Web 2.0, even your grandmother can do a mashup. The goal is to make science collaboration as easy as that. And I don't think we succeeded in the UK science program. But I actually do believe that Microsoft can really help make tools and help make technologies available that can really help scientists and researchers do their work.
So one aspect of your kind of career trajectory that I'd like to draw out here is that you are also an expert in parallel computing, and I believe we're one of the primary authors of the MPI, message passing interface specification. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. I mean, it was. I have been in this on and off for 30 years, so I have very good friends in the high performance and parallel computing community here. And I was involved in European projects, and there was a danger that the Europeans would go one way and the US would go the other way. And really, it was time to see if we could get the community to put together, if you like, a community standard. So it isn't an ISO standard. There wasn't a big standards body. It was a group of experts who got together with the academics and the industry players, and it was rather a small set. And we used to meet every 6 weeks in Dallas Airport, so you really had to be dedicated to go there. But what came out of it was a standard which has, stood the test of time. I co-authored and initiated the first draft of the standard. It got much changed subsequently, so I don't take credit for the final thing. But I did try with Jack Dongarra to initiate, beginning of the standards process, and I think I remember buying the beer at the first session.
So what's interesting to me here is that despite that, you've been someone who has expressed a certain amount of skepticism about the notion of kind of raw, let's call it grid capability, and have been very careful to emphasize that in your view, the real challenges have more to do with data, with the ability to flow data together in, you know, from multiple sources in large quantities and enable people to make sense of it, and that that's you know, kind of orthogonal to the raw clustering capability.
Yes, I used to work in the very high-end supercomputing, parallel computing end, but what I think distinguishes this decade is that we'll collect you know, more scientific data than we have collected in the whole of human history in these next 10 years. And, you know, scientists from being, you know, struggling with very little data will be struggling with huge amounts of data that they can't process, they can't analyze. There may be some data stored in different continents, in different places, and how do you put it together? How do you federate? And I think that is the real challenge. I think the computing, very few people want to use petaflop computers. It's a very small percentage of the users. Most of the biologists, the chemists, the engineers, and so on, use much lower capabilities, which can be provided, for example, by just a simple cluster, and then you put the cluster where the data is, because the data is the thing that's going to be difficult to move around.
Mm-hmm.
With, you know, petabytes of data, that's never going to be easy to move around on the internet.
Yeah, this is actually a really good point that Kirill made in the conversation that we had, and I don't think I've seen this stressed very often, but his point was that, you know, these what I call intergalactic clusters are one-of-a-kind beasts, right? So the Google or Yahoo or Microsoft, you know, cloud infrastructure, those things are not replicable, right? So that means that you have to bring the data to them, and as you say, in cases where there's vast quantities of data, that becomes impractical. But what he's working on in the HPC initiative at Microsoft is also to make sure that it's possible for organizations to stand up their own more modest clusters, you know, at the sites where the data lives. And I think that that's a real interesting kind of tangent. But anyway, I want to kind of get to this opportunity that you see around what Microsoft can do in partnership with these folks. And I found a quote in one of the interviews that I looked up about you, which is, I think, kind of nice. You say, rather than wasting the enthusiasm and talents of science graduate students by assigning them the task of building systems capable of handling, analyzing, and mining petabytes of data, scientists should look to computer scientists and the IT companies to raise the level of abstraction and to provide them with the components of a reliable and functional cyber infrastructure. That seems like a really good, from my perspective, the most concise kind of mission statement for what you're doing.
No, that's exactly right. So, I mean, part of the reasons for my joining Microsoft was because I had a great friendship and arguments and discussions with Jim Gray from 2001 onwards. And, you know, we argued and disagreed on many things, but we also agreed on lots of things. But we agreed in particular on, I think, what is increasingly becoming clear is a different paradigm. You know, there's experimental physics, now there's theoretical physics with Newton's laws and things. And then the third paradigm, which is now clear, is computational simulation, is computational science is there. But what we're looking at here is a data-centric science where you will actually do, if you like, collections-based research, and you'll put things together like you do in mashups, but mm-hmm. they're now scientific data sets, and you'll use, increasingly in my view, semantic information to those stores, which will actually enable you to go from data to information to real knowledge by putting these things together.
Mm-hmm.
And so that fourth paradigm is, I think, the key, and I think one of the reasons I came to Microsoft was partly Jim Gray, but partly because I think companies can help. I struggled mightily with just open source tools. I used to produce open source tools myself as an academic, and the MPI has a wonderful open source implementation, and that was one of the key things that we did. But I also know that, you know, open source typically produced by academics like myself, you know, used to work on my machine, but if you want to work on your machine, that's your problem. And, you know, if you want to be ported to something else, well, that becomes very difficult to maintain and mm-hmm. documentation and testing. So one of the things I set up in the UK was, in fact, a software engineering center called the Open Middleware Infrastructure Institute, where I put a lot of money in to try and take some of these open source codes and document them and test them and make them more reliable and shareable. Mm-hmm. And I, that's why I think that a judicious mix of open source with commercial, it could be from IBM, could be from Oracle, could be from Microsoft, is the way one can actually provide a more reliable infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the motivation and part of the motivation for the tools that we're producing around the technologies that the scientists can use to do their publication, their data mining, or whatever. We can put, you know, open source plugins that will help them and make it more useful for them to do that. And I think Microsoft can really take a lead in here. That's why I joined.
So another nugget that I picked up, you said somewhere, essentially I match up Microsoft researchers with major scientific problems that computer science technology can help to solve. So that leads into the TCI and now the external research charter. So tell us, what are those initiatives?
Yep. So yes, you're right. I came with a purely scientific mission with TCI, and we have now some exciting projects. You know, you've talked to Catherine Van Ingen, and there's been articles by David Heckerman on his work on HIV/AIDS. Yep. But now I've moved into Microsoft Research. We have a bigger agenda, and external research, we focus around four themes. One is, we call health and wellness, which is, you know, fairly obvious. It's bioinformatics, it's medical solutions, this and the other, to do with the biomedical area, and really exciting, and we've got some really good projects in that area. The other one we call E3, Earth, Energy, and the Environment, and it's things like the astronomy stuff that Jim Gray started, which we now have followed up with the World Wide Telescope with Curtis Wong, which I think just got its millionth distinct user after only 2 months. It's a wonderful tool for looking at exactly the sort of things we were talking about.
It's a brilliant thing. I've actually had two in this series, two in-depth conversations, one with Curtis and another one with Jonathan Fay.
That's great, because they're the people who really deserve the credit. So what we're trying to do is put it up as a service so it actually is reliable, doesn't fall over. But it does exactly the sort of things we were talking about. It takes lots of distributed data sets and allows you to search and visualize and do wonderful things. So that's an example of one of the tools in the Earth, Environment, and Energy. The Catherine Van Ingen's project is a example of the environment project. Mm-hmm. And you know, we're doing other ones, like there's a project called the Swiss Experiment, which is, you know, putting sensors all over the Swiss Alps looking for, you know, change, because it's going to actually impact on their water and their snow and their glaciers and all that sort mm-hmm. of stuff.
Oh, and in the health area, by the way, I've been in touch with Chris Tolley, and I've actually done one conversation with one of the folks that they awarded funding to, and
yes.
I'm looking to kind of follow in on that. This was the Genome Association Studies grant.
No, Chris is great. She and Simon Mercer are looking at the biomedical area, and they've got a wonderful set of projects, you know, ranging from, you know, high-tech stuff with RNA and HIV/AIDS down to, you know, last mile of preventative healthcare. So, you know, looking at things in Latin America, how you can take a smartphone and connect to a low-cost diagnostic tool like a blood pressure monitor or electrocardiogram, and you can therefore do healthcare in these remote areas.
So we'll go through the other areas, but let me just jump in and clarify, what is a project? I guess sometimes a project is Microsoft Research puts out an RFP, and somebody like George Hripsack at Columbia is awarded money to, you know, pursue some research that he's already been doing. In other cases, though, there's not necessarily funding. It's more of a pure collaboration, like with Catherine and Dennis.
Yes, I mean, I think there's a variety of things. I think really what I want us to focus on is genuine partnership with the academics. And so, you know, it has to be a win-win on all sides. We don't have to have a fully Microsoft solution, obviously, because that's, I think, not practical in the academic community. Mm-hmm. But there has to be some win for Microsoft somewhere, mm-hmm. that we get some benefits, we understand better our technologies. So what we're trying to do is find all sorts of ways, and RFPs are one. Targeted funding, like we do in TCI, we're still doing, you know, collaborations with academics. Maybe we fund a postdoc and things like that. But other things like delivering software tools, open source tools, delivering data sets. What can we do for the computer science community, mm-hmm. which is another one of our themes, is computer science. What, you know, and I used to teach in a computer science department, and I assure you my department was not atypical. We taught them Linux, Apache, MySQL, PHP, Java, and they used a variety of scripting languages, Perl, Python, and now Ruby on Rails.
Mm-hmm.
And to teach computer science principles, it's quite clear you don't necessarily need any Microsoft technology. So the question is, how do we engage with academics in the computer science discipline?
And what are your thoughts on that front?
Well, I think that we have an opportunity. I think that's exactly where we're refocusing our efforts. What we need to do is work with the community, looking at what services, what data, what resources we can give them, how we can partner in a way that they feel is beneficial, but they can do research the way they want to, and we can find out what services they need, how we can make our tools more valuable. Microsoft does now have the beginnings of some exciting service offerings. I mean, there's Live Mesh, and we have .NET Online Services coming along.
Mm-hmm.
I liked our internal code name CloudDB better than SQL Server Data Services (SSDS).
Well, that's how it always goes.
That's the way it goes. Yes. So that's in beta at the moment, and I hope by the time of the PDC in October, we'll have a lot more concrete things to show in the service area. And what I need to do is see what we can offer the academic community in terms of resources. What can we offer them time so they can explore multi-core, for example? Can we offer them time so they can actually get data sets of a scale which we've anonymized and made available so they can do useful research which they would otherwise be unable to do?
Mm-hmm. And I suppose Dryad,
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So what we're trying to do is to see, we now will in Microsoft Research have some internal resources, cores, and I want to make some of that available externally, and I want to put some services such as Dryad or Dryad Link and stuff. You know, exactly what we'll be able to put out, I'm not yet sure.
Right.
But at the Faculty Summit, what I want to do is actually, you know, go and ask the community. I came from the community. You know, how can we partner with you so that we can give you things that you value and get your feedback? So that's really what I want to go and do.
So what is the Faculty Summit? Who's been invited, and what do you hope to happen there?
The Faculty Summit is a sort of annual event in the UK, and in the US, sorry, and it has roughly 300 academics, 300 or 400 academics come, and they're mainly computer scientists from the US, but there's a sprinkling from around the world. There's from India, from China, from Latin America, and Europe. But some of them are now multidisciplinary scientists and so on. And really, it's an opportunity for us to connect to sort of what I want to try and do is go through the themes. So, I've talked about health and welfare, earth, energy, and environment, and computer science.
Mm-hmm.
The other one is education and scholarly communication.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll be unveiling a set of tools that we think Microsoft hasn't really addressed the scientific or research market because it's done consumers and business. But actually, you know, I'm never going to see a large business there. So why don't we actually release plugins for our tools which make them more useful for scientists to do what they want to do?
So the word NLM add-in is the obvious example of that I know of. Are there others that...
Yes, we're going to announce a Creative Commons plugin, all right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, again, we need to respond. Creative Commons allows you to give away some of your copyright rights. You can retain some, or you can give them all away. And that's a plug-in I think will be welcomed by the community, because many people use Word and use PowerPoint and Excel and are happy that they share them. And we would like to give them a plug-in that will help. And then you talk to Pablo about his e-journal. That's going into beta, so if people want to start a journal, they can do it with low cost because the service is free. We're also going to have a research repository, which is really very exciting, where you can store the output of, I mean, it's what I did in the university. I was looking at, I was supposed to monitor the output of my faculty with 200 academics and 500 postdocs and grad students. Well, what we did was insist we keep a digital copy of not only publications, obeying whatever the publisher said, but you know, presentations at conferences, research reports, theses, and all this sort of, maybe videos, maybe data.
And data, you know, data especially.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's a huge new area, as you know.
Well, it did in my view. You know, my undergraduates in engineering faculty never went into the library for traditional library purposes. They went there for a cup of coffee, chat with their friends, a warm place to work, but not for, as a library. So what is the role of a library? My view is very much the MIT DSpace view that has been promoted, that the role of a research library in a university is to be the guardian of the intellectual output of the university. Mm-hmm. And that needn't just be research, it can be teaching materials. Mm-hmm. And so one of the exciting things, we've used SQL Server and the entity framework, so that's a bit like the RDF model of Tim Berners-Lee and friends, but it captures some semantic knowledge. So it tells you, this is a presentation, Tony Hay gave it, the local organizers were so-and-so, it was done on this day, and so on. So you can capture some semantic information along with the deposit of the data, and we think that's very exciting.
Yeah, yeah. But also the general notion of wrapping services around raw data sets. I mean, this is, well, for all sorts of reasons, but one of them being, you know, the kind of conversations I've had with Timo Hanne at Nature over the years about how, you know, a lot of times nowadays, somebody winds up publishing a paper as, I think Timo called it, a fig leaf to cover basically the publication of data, right?
Yeah.
There's a fig leaf of analysis because really the point is that some data set has been published and there hasn't really been a good mechanism or tradition around that, so that seems to open up some interesting opportunities.
No, absolutely. So Timo and I absolutely agree that research repositories which contain text and contain data are going to be increasingly important.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know that you aren't wild about the term data services, but it's actually a pretty important bit of terminology because, I was talking with Jonathan Fay about, you know, his revelation about finding all of this astronomical data that was online. And on the one hand, it was astonishing to him simply that it was available. But on the other hand, it's, you know, kind of in the grand tradition of academia, right? These were gazipped tarballs that, you know, you can only make sense of if you had sort of an extreme amount of specialized knowledge and capability, right? And so, in effect, one of the things that you get with World Wide Telescope is a service layer wrapped around all of that raw data that makes it accessible and manipulable and, you know, to a vastly wider set of clients, right?
No, absolutely. And that is really the goal of Catherine Van Ingen's stuff.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
This stuff was locked away in files and nobody knew what was there.
Yeah.
By making it available and exposing it in new ways, you're right. So I think these data services are very important and they are the basis of some of our other projects. So, for example, one with Valerie Daggett at the University of Washington. She does protein folding, but she does protein unfolding as well. So she regards, I think, that protein folding ab initio from the beginning with just the structure as too difficult. So she takes the folded structure and unfolds it and then looks at the possible foldings that you get having gone back a bit in the sequence. And so what she's been doing is storing, you know, detailed simulations, and we've made a database with her, and it's she calls it dynamiomics. Right, and so when you do docking calculations, you know, does this protein dock with this particular other protein, just doing it from the static structure isn't sufficient because they jiggle around, and sometimes the bonding site opens up as the jiggling goes on, and that's the sort of thing she's doing, and she's looking at some exciting possibilities for an amyloid inhibitor, which, you know, might have some implications for things like Alzheimer's.
So in that particular case, how would you characterize the nature of the collaboration between Microsoft Research and her? I mean, so in the case of Catherine Van Ingen and Dennis Baldocci, for example, I thought it was a really interesting mesh of kind of interests and capabilities, you know. So Dennis has particular kinds of expertise with climate science, and, you know, he's got his hands on this worldwide network of sensors, but he's not an informatician. Right, and he's not someone with, you know, sort of deep training in how to, you know, sort of probe and reshape a body of data, and that's what Catherine brings to the table. So in this other case, this protein folding case, for example, what's the partnership really about?
The partnership is on two levels. Valerie really is a computational scientist, and she's done these computationally intensive calculations. She uses national supercomputers and so on. One of the things we've done is give them experimental HPC cluster on Windows. So they actually have, instead of using a remote one, they can get a lot of calculations done on the local machine. The other part is that what they don't have are typically you know, expertise in databases. So we've set up with Stuart Ozer, who used to be in Jim Gray's group but now works back in SQL Server. He was collaborating with them, setting up a database so they can actually do things in novel ways. They can explore it through a data cube rather than having to go to the SQL language and so on. So I think the expertise we gave there was twofold, HPC and database, and rather clever database layout and all mm-hmm. this sort of stuff.
And it seems like this database, this sort of transfer of database knowledge and expertise is a pretty strong common thread to a lot of this stuff, right? Because a lot of these, as you say, a lot of these folks are sort of computationally oriented scientists, you know, so they know how to work with algorithms and code, but the data management is just another kind of discipline, right? And not one that necessarily comes naturally to folks.
No, that's right. So we have another activity, which is, you know, computational education for scientists. And I mean, that's something I did in the 80s and 90s, which was about algorithms and parallelism and things like that. But you're quite right. It's now about a different set in addition to those, which is knowing how to do data, how to manage data, how to mm-hmm. manipulate, how to deal with databases and stuff like that, mm-hmm. and the metadata and stuff. So I think there's a new set of skills that we're developing. So we have a set of projects with, you know, with, I think, two Nobel Prize winners, Phil Sharp at MIT and Carl Wieman at Vancouver, looking at the educational aspect. What do you want to teach biologists? What do you want to teach physicists about new skills to generate a new generation of computational scientists who understand the data as well as the computation?
Right.
And I would be remiss if I mentioned Stephen Emmett. His team, he has what he calls a computational science group. I think he would agree that the data is important, but he would think that the complexity of the modeling that you have to do now with this complex data is as important. So I usually emphasize the data more because I think that's the radically new thing. But I think Stephen would argue, and as he did in his 2020 science report, he would argue that, you know, now we have to deal with enormously complex modeling, and therefore some of the algorithms and the abstractions and models in computer science can really help the modeling side of science.
Yeah.
One of the other engagements we have is a joint bioinformatics modeling institute in Trento, and that's an initiative of Stephen Emmett and his team.
Most people understand that Microsoft has a massive research arm, and there's lots of stuff happening internally, and there's been a lot said and written about the sort of internal technology transfer, right? Something gets invented at MSR and it gets thrown over the wall into some product group, right? And people have heard that story a lot, you know, but not so much this, you know, this other story, right, about sort of external collaboration.
That's correct, but it does link to our research within MSR. So we're dealing with the computer science and the education communities. We have wonderful tools here that actually don't end up in products. What we need to do, and one of the things that I hope to do with external research, is make more of these available. We now in Microsoft have two OSI-approved open source licenses, MSPL and MSRL. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to make some of our tools, which are not going to go into products, which are not going to generate large sums of money, to actually be made available so that we can build communities and show what great tools there are, tools that really do things that the computer science community and the science community want. So I talked about our four themes. That was health and wellness, E3, earth, environment, and energy, computer science, education and scholarly communication. In addition, we have what we call ARTS, Advanced Research Tools and Services, where we're trying to actually develop tools and services that academics and scientists, computer scientists, will find valuable. And we have many other, I mean, we just did a count, and last year we had sort of, in total with RFPs and small projects and big projects, something like 400 projects over the whole of Microsoft Research with external partners and universities.
Mm-hmm.
So my challenge is to focus that a bit more and to make sure that we capture and build on the ones that are successful.
Well, very good, Tony. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Thanks very much, John.